Welcome back. Factory Girl from the Rolling Stones' monumental 1968 album, Beggar's Banquet. And a lot of interesting instruments there. Of course, we have Mick on vocals, Keith on acoustic guitar. But there's also conga drums, Ricky Gian, Rick Gretsch of Family on fiddle and violin, Dave Mason, Nicky Hopkins, or Brian Jones. We're not sure which of those three were playing the mandolin, and Charlie Watts on tabla drums. And on this performance, Charlie Watts said, "I was doing something you shouldn't do, which is playing the tabla with sticks instead of trying to get that sound using your hand," which is, of course, how Indian tabla players do it. So there you go, a little background knowledge on Factory Girl from the Rolling Stones. We are about to delve into a very serious territory here, folks. I don't need to tell you, after the horrible slaughter that took place just a few days ago in Nice. And let me just crib here from the inside the dust jacket of a book called Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. Since September 11th, 2001, America has been at war. And that's about all anyone can say with certainty about a conflict that's cost 7,000 American lives and almost $2 trillion. As long as the most basic strategic questions, who is the enemy? Why are we fighting? Remain unanswered. Victory is impossible. Yet this war is eminently winnable if we remove our ideological blinders and apply basic strategic principles. That means accurately naming the enemy, understanding his plan, and drawing up a strategy to defeat him. So says Dr. Sebastian Gorka, one of the most experienced and sought-after authorities on counterterrorism. Our enemy is not terror or violent extremism. Our enemy is the global jihadi movement, a modern totalitarian ideology rooted in the doctrines and martial history of Islam. America has defeated totalitarian enemies before, providing a desperately needed dose of clarity. Dr. Sebastian Gorka is here to show us how we can do it again. He reveals how a toxic political agenda has corrupted our national security practices, precluding the kind of clear-eyed threat analysis and strategic response that led to victory in the Cold War. Taking his cue from the formerly top-secret analysis that shaped the U.S. response to the communist threat, Dr. Sebastian Gorka has produced a compelling profile of the jihadi movement, its mind and motivation, and a plan to defeat it. My conversation with Dr. Sebastian Gorka begins in mere moments, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Sebastian Gorka is an internationally recognized authority on national security strategy and counterterrorism. He holds the Major General Matthew C. Horner Distinguished Chair of Military Theory at the Marine Corps University. He's a regular lecturer for U.S. Special Operations Command, the FBI's Counterterrorism Division, and the Green Berets. And he's briefed the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the National Intelligence Council. A Breitbart News contributor who frequent guest on the Fox networks, as well as the BBC, CNN, and Sky News. Dr. Gorka is the chairman of the Threat Knowledge Group and a recipient of the Joint Civilian Service Commendation Award awarded by U.S. Special Operations Command, and his new book is entitled Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. Dr. Sebastian Gorka, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Very well. Thank you very much for having me.
The gory details of the Nice terrorist attack on Bastille Day, now well known. Obviously, there's new information coming forward, but I want to begin by getting your reaction, because I found this very telling, perhaps symptomatic. The comments after this horrible event made by the French Prime Minister, who said essentially, "France, you need to learn to live with terrorism." Almost sounds like a complete capitulation. What do you make of that comment by the French Prime Minister?
Well, I'm very bothered by it, because that's not how you defeat groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. It's not an issue you just get used to. You don't get used to 80 people getting mowed down on the equivalent of your July 4th celebration. You don't get used to somebody walking into a nightclub in Orlando and gunning down 49 Americans like they're lambs in a slaughtering house. So, yeah, this is part of the problem. We have a lack of leadership. In the last 20, 30 years, the Western world has lost the kind of spine and backbone in our leaders that is required to prosecute and defeat groups like the Islamic State, who can be defeated. And that's why I wrote my book, and that's, why it has the title that it has, Defeating Jihad, the Winnable War. This is a war that can be won, but not without requisite leadership.
Well, it seems to me, and you can disabuse me of this, but it seems to me that the Prime Minister chose his words very carefully. This wasn't just someone in an offhanded remark saying, "Well, this is the new normal. We just have to deal with it." I mean, you combine that with, as you pointed out, this lack of leadership, where we have the current leadership afraid to use the word Islamic terrorism or jihad. I mean, is there something more sinister afoot here? I mean, why are they simply rolling over, seemingly rolling over, capitulating, and telling us, well, get used to it?
Look, I love conspiracy theories. I have a whole bookshelf of them at home, but for me, they're only theories. They're not facts. So let's just look at the reality. There is a deep problem, whether it's in the White House or whether it's in the Elysee in France. The fact is, we are victims, we are hostage to a political elite that has the wrong worldview and also has misdiagnosed the nature of the threat. What's the worldview? On both right and left, we have far too many politicians that don't take religion seriously. If they say they have faith themselves, it's not a deep faith. It's going to church or temple once a week for an hour and using it as a networking tool. It's not an understanding of the transcendental and the power of the transcendental. As a result, they really are not in a position to understand jihadi groups that are committed to killing others in the name of their creator. So there's no way for them to understand the logic, for example, of a suicide bomber. So that lack of faith puts them in a position where they just don't get it. Secondly, in conjunction with that, they misdiagnose where terrorism comes from. This administration, the Obama administration, has an article of faith, ironically, believes that terrorism is the result of lack of education and poverty. They really think, I mean, that's the only way you can have a deputy press spokesperson for the State Department go on national television and say, "We'll be safe, there'll be no more 9/11s as long as we have jobs for jihadis." Anybody that has at least a double-digit IQ knows that is patently fallacious.
They've also blamed global warming. Do you
Yes.
remember that
Oh
one?
my gosh. Oh my gosh. Yes. Yes. Global warming produces terrorism. So if you don't know, so if terrorism were the result of global warming and lack of education and unemployment, half of India would be terrorists. But they're not. So what's missing? Ideology. This administration cannot countenance admitting that people are being beheaded, being run down by trucks, being crucified now because they have a religious motivation. You put those two things together, and you will have the incredible mess that we are currently in.
Give us we don't have time for the full blown, historical perspective, but we do need the historical perspective because we have sort of two camps here, as I see it. On the one hand, and let's call it what it is, sort of a view on the left, is that what we are seeing now, this jihadi terrorism, is kind of blowback, a payback for NATO incursions in the Middle East, bombings in Iraq and you know, the failed state of Libya and so forth. Then the other view is that what we are dealing with, and I'm guessing that you're more in this camp, what we are dealing with is an ideology that is hell-bent on reestablishing the caliphate. And this has been an unchanged motivation for almost 500 years. Nothing has changed in that regard. It has been now more exposed, perhaps, and we can talk about the reasons. So, you know, which line of thinking are you on here?
Well, listen, we may not have time for the full historic details, but your listeners are welcome to go to my webpage, thegorkabriefing.com. That's THEGORKA, thegorkabriefing.com, for lots of free materials. But yes, there's the view of the left that actually blames us. Jihadi violence is a function, is a response to Western intervention in the Middle East, whether it's the first Iraq war, whether it's our actions after 9/11, we are the problem. So that analysis actually makes the perpetrators of terrorism the victim. It is an unconscionable, disgusting view because it blames the death of, you know, children in Nice on us, on the West, and it has to be wholly jettisoned. It's a function of Chomskyite self-loathing just being repackaged in the new 9/11 or post-9/11 era. On the second view, and yes, I'm a conservative. I don't think this is linked to being conservative. I think it's linked to the facts of the case. This war is not a function of America doing anything. It's a function of who we are and why the enemy rejects our values and wishes to destroy us. 9/11 wasn't the beginning of this war, and you know, the events of Boston or Chattanooga or Fort Hood aren't a response to what we've done. We've been fighting these guys for centuries. You can go back 1,400 years if you wish, but let's just talk about America. Do people know why Jefferson had a Quran? A lot of people made a big deal out of this when the first congressman was sworn in as a Muslim in America, and they used Jefferson's Quran, and people said, wow, look how cosmopolitan and what a man of the world Jefferson was that he had a Quran. It had nothing to do with him being multicultural or cosmopolitan. At the beginning of the birth of the Republic, Jefferson and Adams were tasked by Congress to investigate the phenomena of the Barbary pirates, to find out why our ships, our sailors, were under attack, were being taken hostage off the coast of Tripoli. As a result, Jefferson and Adams wrote a 3-page report. People can Google it, can find it online. It's a handwritten report to Congress in which Jefferson writes, "We have investigated what is going on off the shores of North Africa, and we can now tell you, because I have bought a Quran, that the violence against our citizens is a function of their holy text. We are the infidel, and we must be crushed. We must be destroyed. That's why Jefferson had a Quran. We have been fighting this war for hundreds of years, not because of what we did in the Middle East, because the doctrine of jihad is a centuries-old one. And according to it, all infidels, you, me, anybody who doesn't believe in their version of Islam, must be enslaved or must be killed."
And that would include, you know, millions of Shia Muslims who have also been targeted and slaughtered. And if it was simply about foreign misadventures on the part of NATO or the West, then why are there some 50 countries that have nothing to do with any of those incursions being targeted, and again, Shia Muslims being slaughtered?
Oh my gosh, that's such an important point. Absolutely. Not just Shia being executed by the truckload in Iraq by ISIS. Videos online you can see where Shias are being executed one after another, sometimes by children that are killing them. But it's not just Shia, it's Sunnis. I mean, the majority of the victims of the jihadi groups like ISIS, we have to admit, are Muslims, and in many cases Sunnis. This isn't a war with Islam. That's an absurd statement. This is a war inside Islam that also targets Christians, Jews, Yazidis, you name it. But by far the greatest number of victims of groups like the Islamic State are fellow Muslims who disagree with ISIS and who don't wish to live in the caliphate. So, yeah, look at the logic train. How can you blame the death of thousands of Muslims at the hands of the jihadis if their violence is a function of our foreign policy?
But could you... Dr. Gorka, make an argument that some recent foreign policy mistakes have perhaps exacerbated or provided an opportunity, an opening for the rise of some of these extremist groups. For example, the failed state in Libya, choosing to fight two fronts in Syria, to fight both Assad and ISIS at the same time. First, the misadventure in Iraq, and then pulling out, too soon. Could we not say that those point to those failed experiments as providing perhaps an opportunity for ISIS?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You can be stupid and you can exacerbate a problem, absolutely. And the last 15 years have not exactly been a case of America acting strategically. My book is a very bipartisan, I'm a bipartisan abuser in defeating jihad. I criticize the Bush administration and the Obama administration. The idea that you're going to go into Iraq and in a shake and bake venture, you're going to create democracy after 30 years of dictatorship. I mean, that's asinine, but it's just as stupid to think that you can bomb, Libya, get rid of Gaddafi, and everything's going to look like, Swiss democracy in Libya afterwards, or you're going to pull out of Iraq in 2011, and everything's going to be fine in the super corrupt Maliki regime that's exploiting Sunnis and, paying homage to the mullahs in Iran. Yeah, you can make things worse. This is, these are not dichotomous statements to say that it's not our foreign policy that caused terrorism, and to say that at the same time our foreign policy can exacerbate things. Both of these things can be true at the same time, and we have made things worse. I mean, this administration's idea that we can give some jihadis weapons who are less extreme than other jihadis, I mean, that's like a bad Monty Python skit. That's like SNL. I mean, all jihadis are bad, and you think that giving weapons to some of them is going to be good for U.S. national security? No, this is both of these things can be true at the same time, but the final analysis stands. We could get rid of all our military bases around the world. We could stop giving any money to Israel. Do you think we'd be safe? Do you think that the jihadis would suddenly surrender and go away? Of course not. We are under attack because of who we are, not what we do.
Dr. Sebastian Gorka is with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Defeating Jihad, the Winnable War. One of the arguments for not using the word, Republican nominee Trump keeps sort of baiting Hillary Clinton, saying, use the term radical Islamic terrorist, and she said, well, she's prepared to, but she hasn't, so forth. But part of the rationale, we're told, is that if you use that term, you're going to lose the room with the moderate Muslims, those that want to cooperate with the United States. That's simply appeasement. You can't appease them. What is your view on that tactic? What's wrong with it in your mind?
Well, it's completely bogus. I mean, look, this administration would have you believe that religion has nothing to do with this war. These are not the droid you're looking for. When we state that, when Obama or Clinton makes these kinds of statements, we're actually undermining, we are severely weakening our Muslim allies in the Middle East. When King Abdullah of Jordan, when President Sisi of Egypt say that this is a religious problem, when Sisi goes into the Al-Azhar in Cairo, the equivalent of the Vatican for Sunni Islam, and says, literally, he said this 2 years ago on New Year's Day, you, talking to the spiritual leaders, you have to help me engender a religious revolution in Islam because the jihadis are winning. He knows. I've met him. He's a devout Sunni Muslim. When he says this is a religious problem and the bad guys are losing this, the bad guys are winning the war for the heart of Islam.
All right, Dr. Gorker, I've got to step in. We'll take a time out, come back, and continue to develop, to delve into this existential threat against the West. Jihad. Dr. Sebastian Gorka stays with us here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. Boy, that takes me back. High school gymnasium, Pauline Johnson, Pat Benatar, and Shadows in the Night, which is for me kind of an anthem here on Coast to Coast. And Pat Benatar is coming to Casino Rama up in Orillia, not too far from where I'm sitting, the end of July, and I've got my tickets, and the mighty Aphrodite and I will be there, front row and center, enjoying Pat Benatar. Hey, have you checked out Beyond Belief with George Norrie? Coast to Coast AM's very own George Norrie. It's a dynamic discussion on all things paranormal, conspiracies, all things unexplained. And coming up, the next episode, Wednesday, July the 20th, just around the corner, Psychotronic Weapons featuring Dr. John Hall, a good buddy of mine, Dr. John Hall from San Antonio, Texas. What if the nagging little voice in the back of your head is not always your own? Are you going crazy, or are you the victim of a new form of electronic harassment via psychotronic weapons? That's the very next episode of Beyond Belief with George Norrie. You can sign up now, watch full episodes. Just go to beyondbelief.com. All right, when we come back, more of my conversation with Dr. Sebastian Gorka, Defeating Jihad, the Winnable War. Let me just crib here from the introduction under the title, From Communism to Jihad. At first, it may seem peculiar to just dust off one war plan, and a cold one at that, and apply it to today's threat. But this isn't simply an unimaginative exercise in repetition. To begin with, understanding how we analyzed that threat and eventually defeated it is a valuable exercise in itself. Few people know anything about how America really planned the fall of communism in the 1950s and how far-ranging and sophisticated a strategy we had right at the beginning of the Cold War. Secondly, the similarities between the threat we faced then and the threat we face now are numerous and remarkably deep, and therefore, it's all the more important to know what we did as a nation at the start of the Cold War and how we can profit from it today in the post-9/11 world. We'll discuss with Dr. Sebastian Gorka when Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. Welcome back to Coast, Richard Serrett sitting in from Coast Toronto affiliate Talk Radio, AM 640. Dr. Sebastian Gorka on the line, and the book is Defeating Jihad, the Winnable War. Now, before we get into the parallels between how the United States defeated the Soviets during the Cold War and how we must approach this war, let me just back up a moment, because you mentioned the military leader in Egypt, a Sunni, and others who have basically admitted we have a problem within the Sunni religion. So spell it out for us, Dr. Gorka. Is this, in fact, a sort of a software problem where this ideology outlined in the Quran and the Hadith and Sharia, is it telling us really what it is, or is it being twisted and misinterpreted as we've been told by from certain quarters?
Well, what I always say to that question is, why don't you buy a Quran and read it? There's so much absolutely garbage level information being promulgated in the mainstream media about what Islam is or isn't. So I always tell people, well, why don't you check out the primary source for yourself? Read the Quran. What you will find in the Quran is everything. You will find a smorgasbord. You will find nice things about Jews and Christians. They will be called people of the book in the earliest phases when Muhammad was in Mecca. Then you will find in the latter phases, especially chapter 9, awful, martial, frightening things. You will find the war verses, the sword verses, that simply say quite unequivocally, as the word of Allah, unless the infidel converts, you must kill them. That's chapter 9, verse 29, chapter 9, verse 5. So you can pick and choose whatever you like. And as a result, many of the things that the jihadis do are not fundamentally un-Islamic. So today, what we have is a competition between different versions of Islam. We have those, like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda, that are cleaving to a 7th century version that is martial, that is vicious, that is violent, that wishes to enslave all non-believers and build and expand the caliphate, the theocratic empire of Islam. Then we have the other versions of the faith, the ones that are evinced by countries like Jordan or the Egyptians or the Emiratis. And that's a very different one. That's a version of Islam that wants to be friends with us, that wants to be our allies, that doesn't wish to see a religious war between Islam and non-Islamic cultures. The big challenge we have today is the wrong version is winning. The atavistic 7th century violent version is in ascendance, whether it's from on the streets of Nice or whether it's in Christmas parties in San Bernardino, whether it's in the airport at Ankara or Brussels, or whether it's in a nightclub in Orlando. The wrong version is winning, and we have to help our Muslim allies destroy and crush that 7th century violent version of the faith before more people are killed.
According to a Pew Research, and I've heard anywhere from one-third to one-half of worldwide Muslims subscribe to Sharia, one-third to one-fifth of a billion Muslims. First of all, what do you think of that statistic? Accurate, not accurate, and should we be, what is the concern there?
Yeah, so I always get asked this question. So how many of the billion-plus Muslims out there are actually jihadis? Nobody knows. Anybody who says they have that figure is lying. But the Pew poll that you quote is a very important one because it demonstrates how many Muslims are sympathetic to Sharia. Now, Sharia isn't jihad, but Sharia is in many cases is not nice. It's not conducive to what we would say is being a modern nation that respects human rights or equality of the sexes or civil rights in general. And you're right, in the majority of Muslim nations, the sympathy to Sharia law, the kind of law that means a woman is just a fraction of a man, people should have their hands cut off for stealing, women should be stoned for adultery, the sympathy is ridiculously high. It's between 40 and 60% in many of those countries.
90% in Afghanistan.
Oh my gosh, in Afghanistan, in Bangladesh, in Pakistan, hugely problematic, because if that's your attitude, then you, many of those people will also be likely sympathetic to what the jihadis are doing and what ISIS has done. And what ISIS has done is incredibly important. ISIS is the first jihadi group in 90 years to successfully reestablish the caliphate. The caliphate was a real thing for more than 1,000 years. It was disestablished. It was dissolved by Atatürk, the president of Turkey, after World War I. And ISIS has succeeded in recreating it. And unfortunately, for a lot of people, that's good news.
Well, you mentioned Turkey. I was going to save this to later, but now's a good time to slide it in. The recent coup attempt against President Erdogan, who is an Islamist, which kind of flies in the face with, the last 40, 50 years of a secular Turkey where the military every decade or so intervenes and tries to, reestablish a more secular governance in Turkey. Now the theory is that Erdogan planned this coup, staged it in order to root out those who might be sympathetic to an actual coup. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is huge. It's important because in the modern history of the Islamic world, there's only really two models that have worked in ways that create nations that comport with our standards, our values, and universal human rights. And those two systems are Jordan and Turkey. Jordan has been a strong ally, has functioned relatively well because of two things. Its royal family is the Hashemite dynasty, descended from Muhammad, so that gives them some unique credentials that other Muslim leaders don't have. And secondly, the royal family is educated in the West, whether it's in Sandhurst or National Defense University. The king's sister was a student of mine here in America. They're imbued and deeply steeped in Western values, and they also have that credibility that comes from being a Hashemite royal family. And the other model was Turkey. And why did Turkey work? Because a very charismatic, intelligent man called Atatürk said, you can be a Muslim, that's fine, but that's a private issue. Just like the founding fathers separated church and state, in Turkey we're going to separate mosque and state. And Kemal Atatürk forcibly detached Islam from politics, and he made the army the guarantors of democracy and secularity. And that's why we've seen in the last, as you said, 70 years, numerous military coups, because the military said, oh, things are not going well, the Islamists are on the rise, and they'd come out of the barracks and put everything back into its correct place. This seems to have happened just in the last 2 days, but unfortunately, the Islamists were more powerful. Erdogan, as you said, Erdogan is simply a Turkish version of the Muslim Brotherhood. He is trying to turn Turkey from a successful modern Muslim state into a theocratic autocracy. And unfortunately, the military seems to have lost this time, and the bad guys are winning. And that will not be good for Turkey or the Turks, and it will not be good for us or our fight against groups like ISIS.
Yet when word of this military coup attempt first broke out, Western leaders were almost unanimous in supporting Erdogan and saying, you know, that the military must respect the democratic institutions, you know, that old screed. Were they just paying lip service, are they really behind President Erdogan?
Well, look, many of the statements are very interesting if you listen to them in the last 36 hours, because many statements avoided mentioning Erdogan, and they said that we are interested in stability in Turkey, in democracy. It was only our administration that seems to be again picking the wrong side, just as we did in Egypt when the White House dissed the military and supported the Muslim Brotherhood. We seem to be doing it again. So many places were cautious. They talked about stability as opposed to supporting Erdogan, but unfortunately the White House still doesn't get it. In the last 7.5 years, if they've ever had a choice between doing the right thing and the wrong thing, 10 out of 10 times they've done the wrong thing, and most often it's meant supporting or coddling our enemies. Just look at the Iran deal. And on the flip side, ignoring or turning our backs to those people who truly were our allies and wish to be our friends.
I want to ask you about the madrasa, the schools, the Muslim schools, not only in places like Pakistan, but there are Muslim schools in the United States, there are Muslim schools in Canada. What version, I don't know if this is answerable, but what version of Islam are they teaching? Should we be concerned?
Yeah, there are some figures out there. It's very hard to know. There's not a lot of transparency in these issues. For example, you know, what is being taught, what kind of sermons are being preached here in America. We know one thing that should make everybody sit up and pay attention. Far too many mosques and cultural centers are being funded directly by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And this is a problem. Saudi Arabia as a nation was founded by two people, a man called Saud, who would become the progenitor of the Saudi royal family, and a man called Ibn Wahhab. And Ibn Wahhab was the creator of Wahhabism. Wahhabism is the Saudi fundamentalist version of Islam, and it really has flavored, has shaped the foreign policy of that nation. And in many cases, they have funded fundamentalists around the world. So if you look at some of the documents, some of the books, some of the publications available at Saudi-funded mosques, they are fundamentalists. They are about destroying the West. One easy indicator is there's a book called Milestones by an Egyptian called Syed Qutb. That book, written after he came to America in the 1950s, is the screed, is the Bible of global jihadism. It's where the story begins. All groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS can trace their genesis back to the Muslim Brotherhood. And this book called Milestones, which you can access on my website, thegorkabriefing.com, is the manual on how to kill us, and has been found on high-value targets in all theaters. If a mosque in America has Milestones on its bookshelf, that is a problem, and in many cases it will be, because it is connected either financially or through where the local imam was trained to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Recently saw a video on YouTube, and it was an imam in a mosque in, I believe it was Oslo, Norway, and speaking brazenly to the cameras, saying that the West doesn't understand that you don't have to be a radical Muslim to believe in the Sharia. He asked those in the in attendance at the mosque to raise their hands if they considered themselves to be moderate Muslims. Everybody put their hand up, and then he asked them, how many of you believe in Sharia, that the penalty for adultery should be stoning, that the penalty for homosexuality should be death? And virtually everyone put their hands up. Now, I don't know the providence of this video, but I've seen others, a guest speaker, an imam in a mosque in Orlando, of course, previous to this horrible shooting at the gay nightclub. Again, this speaker in the mosque was saying that the humane thing to do, the right thing to do, is to kill homosexuals. I mean, how representative is that viewpoint in mosques throughout the world, and North America in particular?
Well, again, it goes back to this question that there is no such thing today as monolithic Islam. If you go to Indonesia and walk around Indonesia and talk to Muslims there, and then hop on a plane and land in Riyadh and Saudi Arabia, those are two incredibly different versions of Islam. If you go out for a beer into the disco in downtown Amman in Jordan, and then just take a short plane ride to Pakistan, then you'll be in a completely different world. So it really depends where you are. And also, one of the things that I tell people is crucial is where was the imam trained? It's very different to listen to an imam who was trained by the more liberal schools of thought in Jordan versus somebody who was trained by the Deobandi sect of Pakistan. At the same time, it's very, very different to listen to an imam who comes from Egypt versus an imam who comes from Saudi Arabia. So, you know, the fact is it changes regionally. It changes upon the individual traditions of the given country. But in many parts of the Muslim world, this is standard. I mean, homosexuality as a lifestyle, not as the odd occurrence that happens in private, because look at Afghanistan. Afghanistan and the little boys who are kept as you know, sex toys. That's a very different attitude. But if you are an avowed homosexual in your lifestyle, that is punishable by death, and you will be beheaded or you will be hanged, and it will happen publicly. So this is one of the great ironies that, you know, the liberal left, you know, will talk about multiculturalism, but they don't understand that not all cultures are the same, and the values that they espouse will in fact be rejected to the point of death by some of the people who they wish to so respect.
All right, we are coming up on a break. We will return and continue our conversation. Dr. Sebastian Gorka, Defeating Jihad, the Winnable War, and we will discuss sort of the parallels between how the United States defeated the Soviet Union during the Cold War and how they need to apply some of that same analysis and some of those same strategies to the current war against jihad. Stay with us right here on Coast to Coast. My name is Richard Serrett.
Feeling lost? Not by your radio? Grab your smartphone or computer and listen to iHeartRadio. Pick up the free iHeartRadio apps in the App Store or go to iHeartRadio.com.